Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
What if I told you I'd take you to a place you've never been and do something to you that's never been done?
What's up, my strange and unusual friends? Welcome aboard the Mothership Radio Show. I'm Kevin Gassman, your host. Tonight's conversation, we'll be talking blues music with blues legend Joe Lewis Walker. He's a four-time Blues Music Award winner, a 2013 Blues Hall of Fame inductee. He's appeared on multiple Grammy albums. He's known worldwide as the genre's top musical trailblazer. He also won the 2016 Blues Foundation Contemporary Blues Male Artist of the Year. And he has a brand new album that just dropped called Blues Coming On. I'm excited to talk to him. I'm excited for you to hear him as we're going to get strange and unusual with Joe Lewis Walker on the Mothership Radio Show.
Open your mind real wide now.
I'm freaking out, man.
You are freaking out, man.
You know, when you hear about the strange and unusual, what comes to your mind?
Well, it depends on what context it is. I mean, I've been on some strange and unusual shows. I've been around some strange and unusual musicians. I've been around some strange and unusual relatives, you know what I mean? But when he explained, you know, that it was a little bit about, you know, that what could be, I don't like to say, I'm more of like a mystical, that's what I'd say. And I've had a couple of encounters, you know, that's inexplicable, you know.
Have you always been spiritual? Has it always been kind of founded as you grew, as you were growing up?
I guess, you know, my generation, you know, in the 60s was a generation that was sort of searching for things, you know? So, I mean, I've lived with friends that we were practicing Buddhism. I've lived with friends where we were, you know, doing all kind of alternative lifestyles. I'm originally from San Francisco.
Right. You know? I saw that.
I stayed on communes at times. I did all kinds of things, you know?
It was the natural way of life out there, wasn't it?
Well, you know, if you were a young person, 65, 66, 64, you know, 67, I mean, it was obviously a mecca for young people who were looking for answers other than your regular organized religion or your organized politics or your whatever. You know, people were looking at all kinds of things, old Indian rituals of taking peyote, you know, all kinds of stuff. People were doing things, you know, so. Yeah, it was, I think it was a fertile time for people, you know, looking for different ways of connecting with the universe.
Hmm. It seems like that kind of got lost along the way since that started too, don't you think? As far as that movement only lasted for so long before it kind of got suppressed. But it's something I think we all kind of need, don't we? We all need a little bit of that spirituality. We all need to, we don't have the answers to anything. You know, we're told what answers we're supposed to have and we just accept it and move on. But I think there's so much more to it than we're being led on to, you know, and I feel like, you know, through the 80s and 90s and, you know, up until recent, it's been so, it just, hey, don't pay attention to that stuff over there. Don't pay attention to it. You know, keep doing what you're doing over here. But I think we've kind of come to a point where, especially nowadays, where the reality is showing itself and it needs to be exposed, you know, and I think we might be going through another type of movement, don't you think?
Well, I'll put it like this. If you're from the United States, you're taught United States history, and that means history, it's religious history too. You're not told about the indigenous people's mysticism, which is way deeper to me than anything you can, or you're not told about African mysticism. You're not told that Africa had the first Bible. You're told that Timbuktu is the punchline to a joke. Timbuktu is the oldest city in the world with public toilets, with a political hierarchy. But if you're born in the United States, they teach you one set of history, one set of so-called Christianism, one set of things. So unless you are inquisitive, as my generation was, then you will accept a lot of things that you feel in your heart. Well, it's got to be Columbus came to America. He didn't discover it. He came here. When he came, there's a great movie called The Black Robe. If you ever get a chance to see it, it has French subtitles. It's French Canadian. But it's basically this. It's the Indians accepting settlers coming, 1700s, 1600s were in Canada. And what happens is the Indians notice that every time the soldiers come, the black robes come. The black robes are the priests. And every time the black robes come, the soldiers come. Hmm. So most of the Indians who don't subjugate themselves to Christian philosophy, religion, they're called savages. The ones that don't, the ones that subject themselves to Christian religion are called good Indians who can be redeemed from being savages. So, but the Indians that don't subject themselves keep seeing all the other Indians getting slaughtered. So several Indian chiefs said, well, you know what? The way we're going to deal with this, when the black robes come, we're just going to kill them. Because if we kill them, we don't have to worry about the soldiers coming and killing us. Well, you can look at it as that's real history. That is real history. That happened. So what happened when the Indians accepted Western religion? They got annihilated. What if they'd have kept their own religion? Who knows what would have happened? And I'm just not saying that for Western civilization, but it seems that to me, when you get into higher power, this or that, if you go to a Western school, you're not going to learn anything about Buddhism or Hinduism. You're not going to learn anything about anything unless you go hunting it out. One of the biggest people that had a big, really influence on my whole generation looking for another religion was George Harrison. George Harrison did not accept Western religion. He knew it was something bigger. So he started delving into Indian religion from India. And in that, the music, everything about that culture, till today, George Harrison's relatives, his son Danny, his wife, till today, that's what they believe in, which is meditation, which is reincarnation, which is certain things like that. And so I think that, you know, I think you touched on to something there because another thing about it is that so goes religion, so goes a lot of oppression, you know, and that's just the reality of it. And that's just it. I'm sorry.
No, I agree with you. It's interesting you point out that, you know, our history, you know, supposedly began 400 years ago when neglect everything prior to that, you know, and you look at the sacred mounds we have in this country don't get talked about. The sacred sites don't get talked about. There's so much that we don't know about this land that we live on right now that it's been ignored and just forget about everything prior to, you know, the time pilgrims showed up. You know, it's just, and you're right. It's all we know about. It's all they want to teach us is forget about everything prior to that. This is like, life began from, you know, this point on, and this is where we're going to move on to. And, you know, bringing their ideology in and forcing it upon people is how this country became. And it's right, the truth and reality of it all, it needs to be exposed. And if we can really, like you said, you know, the Indian religion or, you know, from India, and, you know, the different ways of approaching life, I guess you can say, is frowned upon. You know, you have to kind of have to look at it in one way, one lens only before people to accept you. I don't know. It's like, I'm not religious. I grew up in a Jewish family, but on our block, we had Jehovah's Witnesses, we had Mormons, we had Catholics, we had Muslims, we had everybody you can imagine just on our block alone. So for me, I was like, why are they different than me? You know, and that's, I don't want to dive too much into it because it's a little bit out of my range.
Yeah.
But I just feel like, I don't know. I feel what we've been told has been wrong, and we need to reevaluate that. We need to relook at what we are and who we are as people. That's
well, you know, it's simple as this. Life is so interesting. It is really a potpourri. It is my favorite Dolly Parton song, A Coat of Many Colors. That's what it is. It's a coat of many colors. That's why you like it. But here's the thing, because people are very, very protective of their religion, and I respect that. You're talking to somebody that went to Catholic school from the first to sixth grade. But every time I had to go to Catholic church on a Sunday, I had to go to Baptist church because my grandmothers were still Baptist, you know. And so I got a real good taste of religions, you know. And as I got older, being of that generation, hippie people trying to find themselves, I got turned on to a lot of other things. Buddhism, of course, you know, we're all influenced by the Beatles, George Harrison, Indian religions. And now I'm fortunate to have traveled all over the world and I can see certain things. And I tell everybody this, I can tell you everything you want to know about Catholic religion because I went to Catholic school. I can go to certain places. I can talk about St. Immedius, St. Francis of Assisi. You know, it's very interesting to me. It really is. I can talk to you about a little bit about Buddhism. I can talk to you a little bit about Hinduism. I can talk to you a little bit about Jewish religion. My wife's Jewish. I lived in a house with nothing but Jewish people. I can talk to you about, but I defy anybody from really flip the switch who came from a Catholic family to know anything about Buddhist religion or because they're not interested. They simply think that what they read in that one book, that's it. And to me, the whole thing about it is that, like life, it's so much more interesting if you can learn about your Mount Rushmore, Jefferson, Lincoln, Roosevelt, Washington. Well, you know, my grandmother's full-blooded Indian. I'd like to see another Rushmore with Sitting Bull, with Chief Joseph, with Red Cloud, who owned a third of America during the Indian Wars, and Crazy Horse. You've never seen a picture of them, but go back and look. Google some of the sayings. All their sayings were all connected to the earth. There was not a word for lie, Native American. There's no such word for lie. If you lied, you would ostracize. And there's all sorts of sayings that benefits the world. You know, I mean, it gobsmacks me, as they say in England, that if you have an intellect that wants to know about the world, then you would open up to it. Just to see one thing is sort of like, you know, you've got a box of colors and all you use is one color. All you use is one color. I mean, would we buy a Van Gogh painting? Would we buy a Renoir? Would we buy anything with one color? I don't think so.
No.
You know, so I think it's interesting. You know, I just think it's interesting, and I respect all religions, you know, but I subscribe to none, you know.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. It's like to me, you can believe what you want to believe, but at least have some respect for other people who want to believe something different, you know. And some people just can't seem to cross that bridge for some reason. I don't know what it is. It's a block, you know. It's a block inside here that just doesn't open up for them, or they're not willing to open up for it. And it's hard to figure out, you know. I was on your website. I noticed a quote from one of your songs: "The water is deep, the water is cold. It chills my body, but not my soul." And I like that, man.
Well, that's not my lyric. That's an old. As long as you can sing gospel music, it's a lyric from a song called "Wade in the Water."
Okay.
I've done it. Bruce Springsteen did it. A million people have done that song. But it's one of those songs where it's cathartic. You know, you can sing it as the gospel. You can sing it as whatever you want to do, because the lyrics are very, 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 they're timeless. You know, they're timeless. And it's "Wade in the Water." And you could say "Wade in the Water" is about being baptized. Or you can say the weight in the water is about the water cleaning you off, euphemistically and literally. So, I mean, the lyrics are great. It's like the lyrics to Amazing Grace, you know, which is just incredible, because the guy that wrote the song, you know the story behind Amazing Grace, the guy that wrote the song was a slaver. In some kind of way, it's one of those moments like Paul had when he became Saul, you know, and God supposedly striking him down and said, Paul, why are you hurting my people? And after that day, he became a saint. He became someone that started, you know, converting people to Catholicism. Anyway, to make a long story short, that song is one of those songs that have done like Amazing Grace. The guy that wrote Amazing Grace was a slaver who gave away everything. afterwards and wrote that song. That's his claim to fame. But if you really want to know the story, there's a movie called Amazing Grace. And it literally, the movie is about the end of slavery in England, you know, and the people that ended it, you know, one gentleman in particular, I can't call his name right off the top of my head. He was in the House of Commons and Lord. I'm a history buff, so I like stuff like that. Nice. But anyway, that song, it just shows you the power of a song, one song. But the movie, if anybody gets a chance to see it, I'm sure a lot of people who are going to listen have seen it, and they're going to say, "What? You haven't seen Amazing Grace?"
I'll look. I haven't seen it, I'll be honest, but I definitely want to now. So it's just curious to me as well. What do you think it would take for people to open up? What do you think it would take for them to realize that they are in their own box?
Well, I think this. I think it, me, my points of reference are musicians that I revere, or certain figures in history that I revere. And usually they're people that are seekers, that are seeking. I mentioned George Harrison, one. You know, I mean, I played Liverpool 100 times since the 80s. You know, I can only imagine what it was like in the 50s. But for, you know, George Harrison or John Lennon or Paul McCartney to come out of that environment and then go seeking around, not only with their music, but with their hearts and their souls. You know, George Harrison never wavered from transcendental meditation, but he never wavered from seeking. And when he found what worked for him, Hare Krishna, Krishna Rama, you say it over and over again. It's a mantra. It worked for George. It worked for a lot of people. A lot of people are still chant. Okay, you go from that to someone like Bob Marley. Everybody likes Bob Marley. I've never met two people on this earth that did not like Bob Marley. It's sort of like Nelson Mandela, you know, and you say somebody that was a rebel that all of a sudden got accepted for being a rebel, but never changed from being a rebel.
Right.
And you got Marley with Rastafarianism. Rastafaria believes in the Bible. They read the Bible all the time. But their view of the Bible is the living God is here on earth. You know, you hear it in the song, Get Up, Stand Up for Your Rights. You hear Peter Tosh say, we're sick and tired of Israel, trying to go to heaven in Jesus' name. We know and we understand the mighty God is a living man. They believe the mighty God was Haile Selassie. American Indians believe in a great spirit, which was the earth. Okay? So you have all that, and I think all that comes from people who are seeking. You know, seeking. And that's sort of like I am, you know. But it's amazing that someone like a Marley or George Harrison would be touched from seeking, and in the same way in their music as they were in their spiritual life. If you listen to a George Harrison song, I defy you to find me a negative George Harrison song. Mm. Where he says anything really, you'll find it in a tax man. You know, if I walk too much, you'll tax my feet. Right. It's a complaint, but you're never going to find him doing a I hate you song or a put down song. Whereas Bob Marley, he's going to straight sing like a sufferer. You know, he's going to sing like a sufferer. And then he's going to sing like a revolutionary. I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot the deputy. You know, but this is, if you listen to the song, the sheriff was coming after him every day, every freaking day. So he had to do something with it. And you love it, because if you knew Bob Marley, then he meant it. It wasn't a persona. You know, it's like, I get tired of getting stopped for nothing, the 3 o'clock roadblock. You know, and you think, you fast forward it to today, to what's going on today. I'm with you, Bob.
Yeah, it's true prophet, isn't he? I mean, it's and I'm a Bob Marley lover too as well. So, and it's ironic that I put my Beatles hat on today. I had no clue that we were going to be kind of bringing them up a little bit. I had literally dug this hat out of my closet a couple days ago. So it's interesting that you were talking about that as well. Let's talk about some experiences that you've had. John told me that you had a ghostly experiences, or you had some interesting things happen to you.
You know, I've had some inexplicable things, but one I do remember about 35 years ago, I used to live in an attic. You know, in San Francisco, when I was living in San Francisco, where I'm from, they have all these old Victorians. And it was a three-story Victorian, but it had an attic to that. And that's where I was crashing at. My friends let me stay there, no rent. And I'd go up there and I'd practice, but it would get hot, you know, and I'd leave the window open and the little cubby hole open. And I'd go play and just crash out, you know. And you know how you get into a deep sleep. One evening, like twilight, it wasn't daytime, wasn't night, and it was a transition from day to going in. And I was playing, and I just got sleepy, and I just laid down and put my guitar down. And then I don't know how long I was sleeping. And you ever have those feelings where your eyes are closed, but you feel like they're open?
Yes.
And you feel like you're in a deep sleep, but you can't get up. And I it's like my eyes were open now, and there was three ladies, older ladies, hovering over me, moving like this. And I just heard one of them say, well, I don't know about him. And one of them said, well, no, he's the young guy that plays the guitar. He's okay. Leave him alone, you know. And then it was gone. And, you know, every time, and I woke up and I went down and I asked my friend, I said, hey, Barbara, did you see any, you got some friends come up or anything? She said, no. I said, well, I was up in the attic and, you know, something really weird happened. And she says, yeah, that attic's got some mojo going up there, Joe, you know. She says, you okay? I says, well, I guess I passed the test, you know, or the audition. Because, I mean, it was cool. But every time I'd go up there afterwards, I just feel a little something in that attic. But I wasn't scared, you know, but I just felt like there was something had happened in that attic years before. And I think those three ladies were connected, whatever had happened. And I'm not trying to read too much into it, but I think my music, when I was up there playing, made them feel good.
Interesting.
You know, and it sort of, I don't, something about it that connected where I was coming from musically to sort of ease their soul, if that makes sense, you know.
It, I mean, you heard them talk. Did you?
See, oh, yeah.
Did you see them talking?
I couldn't see them as clear as I see that that painting behind you. It was like foggy, but not fog. This is San Francisco where the fog rolls in, because I was on 38. I was on 48th Avenue that stand there. But it was just like, I don't even know how to explain it. It was like you're sleeping and then you think, oh, I'm woke, but I'm not woke. I can't move. And I'm sleeping, but I'm not asleep. I can't say anything.
Right.
You know, it's one of those feelings. And I just got the feeling. And I guess a big part of it was that I wasn't scared. I didn't feel like I had done anything wrong or anything. I just felt like I just lay there and listen. And I'll never forget, I just heard the first one say, well, you know, there he is. So that I just got the feeling they had seen me up there before.
Right.
They had heard me up there before. And the other one said, oh, leave him alone. He's the nice person that plays the music. He's the one that plays the nice music, something to that effect. And the other person didn't say anything. And I eventually woke up, but I it's funny. I remember it to today like it was I told this story to Kenny yesterday. And I remember that story. I remember it like it was yesterday. You know, it was just one of those encounters.
You know? It sounds like you experienced sleep paralysis, where you can't move your body and there's the feeling of someone there. That's not unusual. Where you, because you,
well,
said you can't move
your body. I don't know. I've been several times, you know, I think everybody's experienced a thing where they feel like they're sort of woke, but they see something or hear something or feel something and they feel like they might be awoke, but they're not, you know.
Yeah.
It isn't something you could notate down. It didn't feel like anything I've experienced regularly.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
That's an interesting thing to witness.
And, you know, I really didn't try to figure it out or, you know, I just, it was just something that I experienced that I couldn't explain. And I just know what I experienced. I know what I saw. I know what I felt. I know what I heard.
Right.
You know, and it must have been something because it stuck with me. Jesus Christ, this happened to happen to me in about 1971, maybe 70, maybe 69.
Left an indelible mark on you. And to have the person that lived there confirm that some weird things were happening, I must have felt a little better for you, right? To know that they were like, yeah, there are some weird stuff going on up there.
Well, I mean, and I've had that happen to me a couple of times. I used to live in England, and I toured in England in the early 80s, and I used to stay in a lot of bed and breakfasts before they called them that over here, B&Bs. And I used to stay with a Mr. and Mrs. Ledger. And Mr. and Mrs. Ledger would let me stay up in their room. And they put me all the way on the top floor. And I asked them, I'll never forget. I said, well, can I play that harpsichord? You know, and says Joe, it was the kind of harpsichord you have to push with your feet like an organ. And then it'll, you know, and I'll never forget. I was, me and the bass player were staying there. And we were either coming from the gig. I think we came from the gig, and we heard the harpsichord player. And you know, I looked at him and said, "Man, you hear that?" And so we went up there, and there was nobody there. I had some pretty weird ones from England. I had another one in England that was a little bit weirder than that.
What was that?
You know, but that was after a gig. We were playing in Hull, England. I never forget in that. On a long tour, and so all these young ladies came dressed, you know, like sort of like goth before goth, you know. And so they came and they introduced themselves to us on the break for the, and they said, well, we'd like to invite you to our shop. We have a shop, you know, it has mystical things and this and that and the other. And so, you know, I mean, we're all four young guys, we're thinking, oh, well, we go to the shop, we're gonna have some fun, you know. And so we go to the shop after the gig. And I'm looking at the shop, and there's different incenses and little mystical things and this, that, and the other. And the headdress says, well, you know, you guys come have some tea in the back room. We want to show you something. So she pulls the thing, and there's a 5-star pentagram on the floor, right? And so it's four of us in the band. And so the young lady, she walks around, the girls are walking around to each of the guys and saying, well, you know, we're going to try something different. You know, you guys want to, you know, try something sort of out of the box. And she went to the keyboard player. And of course he said, yeah, I mean, he's a beautiful young lady. The bass player said, oh, whatever. And the drummer, yeah. And the girl looked at me and she said, she seen a cross on my neck. She says, when were you born? I said, I was born Christmas Day. She says, you might not want to stay. And I left. And really, I left. And this is a true story. The next day, I asked all the guys in the band, what happened? Tell me all the sort of details. None of them remembered anything. They didn't remember jack. Zero. They remember drinking some stuff, and they don't remember anything after that.
Wow.
And I told them, I said, yeah. I said, okay. I ain't going to no room with no 5-pointed star. Yeah. That ain't me.
Yeah, I would probably question it too. I'm like, what's going on here? That's and when was this? What year was this? Remember?
Oh, this is about 1989.
Okay.
You know, I was touring England for the 100th time. Yeah.
Oh man, I don't. Yeah, maybe it's better you didn't do that. Have you ever talked to them since? That they still don't remember at all, or that just. This is a blank memory.
No. Mm-mm.
Wow.
And the keyboard player was my roommate. He came back to the room the next morning, you know, and I said, Kev, man, what happened, man? He says, Joe, I swear to God, I don't remember. He says, we drank some stuff, man, and I just can't remember. And I said, well, you know, you better be careful, man, because, you know, we're, and it's weird because we had, I think 2 days before we had went to Stonehenge, and, you know, that's when you could go and just hang at Stonehenge. Now, it's like a tourist attraction. You got to wait an hour and a half, 82 tourist buses. Then you could just go and just go straight to Stonehenge. Now you got, you know, it's this and get your Stonehenge stuff, you know, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
But, and that was an experience, you know, Stonehenge is one of those weird experiences, you know.
Do you think your music or just blues music in general kind of attracts more spiritual people, or do you think there's a connection there somehow?
Well, my personal music, what comes out of me, is not blues. My music that comes out of me is an amalgamation of all the things that has influenced me. Where I'm from, psychedelic rock, the jazz players I played with, like Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, the rockabilly guys I played with, like Scotty Moore, and people I respect, like Carl Perkins, all the rock guys I played. My music is all that, but I come out of the church. See, so I haven't always been in this genre. In fact, I spent 10 years playing nothing but gospel music, 1975 to 1985. When I came back to playing secular music, I played it with my own way. You're not going to come to a Joe Louis Walker gig and hear me do Sweet Home Chicago. I can't do it any better than Robert Johnson did it. So I'm not going to hang my hat on that, but I will do some songs that are amalgamation of my gospel inspirations, influences, jazz influence, blues influence, rock influences, so that my songs are sort of my story, you know?
I think when I listened to the album, Blues Coming On, I felt a lot of different vibes from your, you know, different songs were bringing a different sound. It was a nice album, man. It had me going to the 60s to, you know, to the 80s and the 90s today. And a mixture, like you said, a mixture of everything you've experienced in your life that you put together. It's really nice, man.
Well, even if you just start with the first song, Feed the Poor. Feed the Poor is something that is infused by the generation I came out of. I came out of a generation that we did benefits. We had kitchens where we fed the poor, where we fed the hungry, you know, where we helped people get housing. When I was 16, 17, we do benefits for Bread and Roses, which was Joan Baez's sister, Mimi Farina's organization, where we'd go into mental institutions, we'd go into prisons, I did benefits for the Gray Panthers, who were like the Black Panthers, but they were older people of all different colors, and who were really working to work on senior rights. They were precursor to that. We did benefits for women's rights, especially, you know, in 66, 67, 64. We did a lot of benefits and a lot of marching for gay rights in San Francisco. We did, and of course, for civil rights. You know, and so I am always open to that. So that song, Feed the Poor, the first song on there, the lyrics were written by my young friend, Gabriel Jagger. And Gabriel wrote the some poetry and sent me the lyrics. And we got this whole thing started with the lyrics that Gabriel wrote. And Gabriel was only 19. It was a book of poetry he wrote. He wrote, people lying in the gutter, no father and no mother. Everyone walks past and they're hypnotized by money's trance. And when he played, when he sent me those stanzas, I said, that's where I'm going to start this record, right there. And so what me and Gabe did, we said, it was Gabriel's idea, Joe, let's give part of the proceeds to food banks, because he's from England, of course, you know, Jagger, and I'm from America, you know, and we meet in an island that his dad sort of owns. And I've been doing that for 10 years. And that, when I played that island, that's to benefit the less fortunate islands. I've never been paid to play on Mix Island. I don't want any money. None of us. We do the Basil Charles Foundation to send young people who aren't as fortunate to give them diabetic testings. We've sent, I don't know about 60 young people through high educational school, four lawyers. So I feel good about that. And so I like that to infuse the record. And so when I had people like Yorma from Airplane play on it, Yorma is like an older brother to me. I remember when he moved to our neighborhood in the Fillmore District, you know, before he was even in Jefferson Airplane, I think. And so I've known Yorma. He comes out of that same little bit generation before me, where our thing was given back. Okay, I've known John Sebastian, the same thing. You may be known for the Loving Spoonful, but giving back, we just did a benefit for the Bahamas about 6 months ago. And John came and played with me, and me and him do stuff. And we all sort of come out of that generation. Juma Sultan, who played percussion with Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. That's Juma. He's all on this record playing. Wadi Wachtel, one of the expensive winos with Keith. you know, the expensive winos, with Keith Richards. Roddy comes out of that same thing. Roddy's 4 or 5 years older than me. And so that's the sort of the thread that's running through this record, you know, is that not only is it the music that we make, but it's also why we started making music. You know, why we started making music was, it really, I'll be honest, as Pollyannish as it sounds, I think my generation started making music to change the world. You know, you can start from the Beatles, you can start from Marvin Gaye, "What's Going On, Mama, Mama." You can go a little bit later on to Bob Marley, you know, all that. You can go to John Lennon, God bless John Lennon. You know, all the way, I can say this right now, and you would know what I mean. John Lennon and Yoko Ono in bed in Amsterdam, what song were they singing?
"Give Peace a Chance."
Ain't that powerful? To this day, and for the end of time, here's a guy that started like a teddy boy, a skinhead, that ended up being writing stuff like "Imagine." You know, I mean, just think about it. You know, you really think about it, and you were saying that sort of is template is sort of missing today. And what's happening today is that now all the young people who didn't have skin in the game, they've got skin in the game now, because they've envisioned 4 or 5 things that have been cathartic. We're all been in a room at home together, locked in, right? Everybody has seen 2 murders. You can't unsee a murder, okay? Before it was, what did they do? Who was running from a, he must have done something. Well, now we see. And just to add insult to injury, you get to see a 75-year-old man in Buffalo get pushed to the ground. Everybody seen it. Everybody saw it. And that gentleman didn't, that could be my grandfather, your grandfather. He doesn't have a right to protest. And to have someone say that he had some secret Dick Tracy machine taking, you know, so you have the younger generation now being gassed, beaten for what they believe in. Well, you know what? That was me. I got took to jail when I was a kid. They took me to jail with my mother once, you know. So I know how these young people feel. And when somebody says, oh, well, the looting to this, there's knuckleheads and everything. You know what? I'd like to be the one to go into Congress and see all those jerks that are looting. All these, them's the biggest looters in the world. But now you have all these young people who are just fighting the power. And I just got one last thing to say about that. They just created a whole new generation of Bob Dylans singing masters. They created a whole generation of Bob Marleys. They created a whole generation of John Lennons. They created a whole generation of Marvin Gaye's. They created a whole generation of Huey P. Newton's, Stokely Carmichael's, White Panthers. But that's all they did. That's all they've done. And I've got faith in these young people. I really do. I have, because the old guard has to go.
I agree with you 100% on that. And, you know, you talk about the music that you grew up on. It was authentic. It was genuine. It was from the heart. And for some reason, for so long, we kind of got away from that and let that kind of stand on its own. But you're right. And it's this that we're seeing or witnessing that's bringing out, hopefully, what you're saying is these new writers, these songwriters, these that can probably and will change the world for the better. I feel like that's where we're at right now. This paradigm shift that we're breaking through is necessary, you know, but it's for the better for all of us to be treated the same, you know. It's sad to watch what's going on, but it's a necessary protest that needs to get resolved, you know. It needs to get resolved, and it just needs to be, I don't know, it's sad to watch, man. It's
tantamount to this. What kind of world were we before this, the lockdown? What kind of world were we on a trajectory to leaving our kids and grandkids and grandkids? Okay, well, start right here. They've had 3 years of just straight out vitriol coming from the highest powers. Okay, to me, that hurts me to see, say, some kid who's 10 years old to hear 3 years of these people are that or these people are that and not really, you know, that means something. But here's one. We were leaving a planet that was destined to have serious issues with climate control, okay? Before we get into whether the person believes in climate control or not, and they say, I'm not a scientist. Okay, there's 99 scientists right there that said it. There's one scientist right there that I don't know what drug he's on, but y'all got him. Okay, 99 to 1, what's your odds? But try this on, Prasad. Before all this here happened, go to Google Earth. Look at the Earth, December of last year. Look at the Earth. You see the smog, you see everything. Look at the Earth in April or May of this year. Almost clear as a bell, okay? They could see the Himalayas from India, okay? So now, we were told that it would take years for the Earth to go back. No, it really didn't. Only thing it had to do was send all our butts in the house and leave it alone. Animals were out there smoking cigarettes and turning on their diesels. So now, you have young people like Greta Thunberg coming over, reading the UN the Riot Act about the Earth they're leaving us. You have young people like Malala in Afghanistan who got shot in the face, got the Nobel Prize, and kept on teaching. And she's 14 years old. And you got a lot of 60 years old sitting at home on their butt saying, oh, there's a group of bad kids. Man, I could show you a whole bad group of adults. But my point is this. Now, we have an opportunity. Right now. Okay. This is Joe's little two cents. If you drive a car and your license plate ends in an even number, a 2, a 4, a 6, only like-minded people with an even number can carpool with you. They get to ride on rapid transit for free to work and back. Okay. If you have an odd number, you go on the other days. Like-minded people. That would cut our emissions just about in half. Worldwide. We were in the climate accord changes. Simple, easy peasy, baby. We ain't got to change nothing. We're already in the house, right? But you know what? If you can't get a son of a gun to wear a mask, it's very strange because the rest of a big part of the world are wearing masks. They're going down. So we have a chance to do something like that. And I would like somebody to tell me, and I'll be 71 this year, what's so hard about even an eye? What is so, just to go to work, you know, you can do wheelies in your house if you want to, then you can have your gun and say, you know, oh, I want my freedoms. Okay, great. But if you're 50 and 60 sitting on the couch, your butt's going to be dead in 20, 30 years. Malala, all these kids that are marching, the majority of them, they're probably just going to be paying off their freaking student loan, you know? And so, like, they have all the incentive in the world, these things. When you start talking to older people about changing the climate, changing reforms of certain things, I love it because they have more excuses than a son of a gun going to jail for not doing it, you know? I guarantee you these young kids are going to amount to stuff because when it's all said and done, the ones that aren't looting, the ones that are out there doing good things, those are you and my children and grandchildren. So if we want to start killing our own kids like we did at Kenton State, well, have at it.
I feel like this is kind of the last hurrah for that old mentality to try to hold on to what they had and not letting it go. And they want to keep holding on to it. They want to hold that power, but they're going to lose it. And the progression is going to make it happen regardless if they want it to or not. And that's why you're right. This younger generation, especially what they're seeing and witnessing in this age of technology, it's and this, you know, togetherness that you can, you know, obtain, you know, online, is definitely a new movement. And I have faith in the younger generation as well. I do. And I believe that once we get, you know, maybe starting 2021, we'll start moving in a, once we get rid of the, you know,
yeah, once things change,
Exactly. I'm an optimistic guy. I like to think the positive, you know, will eventually win over, and it will. It's just a matter of getting these antiquated mentalities out of the way. That's all
I go along with that. And I just leave it at one thing. I remember Bob Marley saying, they interviewed him one time and he was, I was living in England and I'll never forget it. and they were saying, well, you know, you believe in this Rastafarian thing and all this stuff, and you believe in that, but aren't you scared of the atom bomb? Aren't you, you know, scared that man's going to blow up the earth and it's going to be the end of the world? And Bob Marley just turned to him. He says, no, man's just going to blow up man. The earth's still going to be here. And I just said, you can't get no direction now. Just think about it. The earth's been through all kinds of some meals with dinosaurs, with this, with that, with atomic bombs, and it's still here.
The earth will recover, right? And yeah. I think George Carlin had a bit. He's like, you know, people trying to save the planet. He's like, the planet's gonna be fine. It's the people who are effed, you know.
Yeah.
The planet will recover. It's the people that, you know, the planet treats us like we're fleas on its body, you know. The planet will shake us off, you know, when it's time.
I mean, you know, and when you really just want to really just look at certain issues. I mean, when I was coming up, me and you, we're fortunate. We never lived through anything like this in our formative years. You know what I'm saying? But just think, you go to school, you can't graduate because of this. You go to college, you can't graduate. You can't bond with your friends. So what do young people have to look up and think about? They look at the internet, they see what's going on with people like mine at their age, being beat up, being knocked down in the streets, this and that and the other, and they see all other things, and now people's attentions are, it's like that thing, do I have your attention now? Well, your attention is here now. And I hate to say it, but once you see something like a person be murdered on TV in front of the whole world, in the space of 3 weeks, one guy getting shot, hunted down like a dog, okay? I'm out already. And then you see another guy get basically choked to death. And here's the thing. Me and you, when we were young, we didn't see stuff like that. We couldn't go on YouTube and see a murder. Once you see a murder, you can't unsee it. So then the thing becomes, where do you stand in a situation like that? Now, how can a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, an 8-year-old, and they all watch internet, every one of them. And if they don't watch it, their old brother and sister is going to show it to them. They're going to say, look what they did to that guy. And the first thing, when you're that young, you're going to say, what? Why are they doing that? I thought they just do it in the movies. And to have someone else say, well, you know, maybe he did this. Well, he had a record for this and that. You can't explain that away. And a young heart and a young soul hasn't been touched, really, by all that infuses that, those horse blinders and those dog whistles. So I really feel that this next generation coming up is going to have seen some things and experienced some things and stood up for some things at an early age. And when that happens to you, it infuses you for the rest of your life, because you get a feeling of two things, right and wrong. And I don't care if you're the guy with the shiniest suit and you had all the answers. If you're wrong, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. If you're wrong, you're wrong. The police can be right a lot of times. They was wrong. Because if I'd have done that, I'd be in jail. If you'd have done it, you'd be in jail.
Yeah,
it's a horrible thing to have to see when you're 12, 11 years old.
I have a hard time watching. Not that I watch it. It's like even when it was like on for the first time, I couldn't watch it. I'm like, I'm not going to sit here and watch somebody die. I don't want to watch that. This shouldn't be happening. It's disgusting. It's... Yeah, you know, and you're right. I think when kids are at that age watching something like this, it has to impact their lives much more so than you would think. It's just, and I don't know, it's just, it's sad. It's sad to watch this stuff. And you know, and if it took this to get those rotten apples and the whole rotten system to be revamped, then, you know, then that's where we're at in this time right now. It happened, and it's, you know, I don't know. It's just
it's just the right and the wrong. And we all want to teach our kids right.
Right.
You know, we all want to point out wrong when we see an aberrant behavior, because we don't want our kids thinking that that's a normal thing to do.
Right.
If you see something, like they say, if you see something, say something.
Right.
And so that's what the people who were there on the scene tried to do. They were scared to do something because they were being threatened by the powers that be. Well, you know, I know it's hard to look at, you know, but it is like what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. I think the reason this has taken so long for some resistance to happen, because people didn't see it. Mm-hmm. If they'd have seen what happened to Trayvon Martin, if they saw Eric Garner get choked to death, you know, over some cigarettes. Well, you know, take the white black out of it. Take the race out of it. If I see somebody doing that to a dog, I am going to try to stop them. You know, it's just the humanity in me. And I think what happens, if you let things happen like that, it eats away at your humanity, you know?
Yeah, there's a, you know, when that video happened with George Floyd, I feel like if I was there, I would want to just bum rush that cop right off his body, you know? Just like, why isn't somebody trying to... Yeah, it's just, it's sad to watch, man. It's really sad to watch, but, and hopefully we'll never see that again, you know?
Well, I doubt that. All you got to do is go on your internet. You see it variation every day. I'm sorry to say, I have to be optimistic that, you know, things, within the next 6 or 7 months, hopefully, will change for the better, you know, and we won't be so much a house divided as a house trying to as a bunch of us trying to clean our house.
Right.
You know,
I hear you, together. Man. Joe Lewis Walker, man, it's been an enlightening conversation with you. I appreciate your time. Just one more question here real quick. Blues music. Will there ever be a time we don't need blues music?
Well, you know, I don't think so. Because you can take a song. Here's the lyric. Here's the musical accompaniment. Get rid of the music accompaniment part. Just throw it away. Throw it away for 10 minutes and just read a lyric. I've been down so long, down doesn't bother me. I've been down so long, down doesn't bother me. If it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have any luck at all. If you sang that to about, I think it's 50 million Americans out of work now. Hmm. I think that you don't need, you catch my drift, you don't need the music. I think they said, you singing our song.
Right, right.
You know?
I can relate to that.
Because right now, I mean, you know, who'd have thunk?
Right.
You know, I think that the music, I always tell everybody, for me, Shakespeare might have been one of the first blues guys. Because what all he did was take the human condition and put it in a play, put it on a piece of paper and get the people to act it out. Blues, human condition. Okay. It's all about the human condition. Don't judge a book by its cover. You know, don't judge a book. You know, you can't you see you've misjudged me. You may think I'm a hater, but I'm a lover, because you can't judge a book by its cover. Well, you know, it's the blues, you know, and the blues means the truth, and the blues means credibility, and it means authenticity. But the mostly authentic part is that it helps when you've lived a bit of what you're singing about. It comes across a little bit more authentic. And the blues will be here as long as there's a person with a guitar singing about their experiences. You know, I mean, let's face it. Everybody can't sing, you know, who's that doggy in the window? You know, I mean, not to knock that, but every, you know, if you wake up and every day you're singing about a silver spoon, what do you have to sing about? You know,
I hear you, man.
That's my story. Yeah.
Right on, man. I appreciate that. That's, I thank you for your time, man. Is there anything?
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, right on. Is there anything else I maybe missed or anything that?
Well, no, just that, you know, I'm glad this record come out. I thank all the guys and ladies that sang on the album: Carla Cook, Sam Cook's daughter, Yorma, my friend, Mitch Ryder, Arlen Roth, Albert Lee, Juma, my good friend Whitey Wattel, and the Winos, and just everybody, Jesse Johnson from the Kinds, Jelly Bean Johnson. Who am I forgetting? Ray Walker, one of the last living Jordanaires, and everybody else who participated. I appreciate everything, and I appreciate you for having me on, and I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, not at all, man. I appreciate it. Appreciate your time. Appreciate you, your music, and keep touching people, man. Keep, you know, making them feel better about themselves, man. That's what it's all about, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Right
yeah.
on. I can't thank you enough, man. This has been really an interesting conversation.
Pleasure's mine.
Right on.
It was
man.
Interesting. Thank you.
Take it easy, man.
Okay.
Tons of knowledge right there with Joe Lewis Walker. We are going to play a song from him off his album, Blues Coming On. Like we talked about during the interview, this one's called Feed the Poor on the Mothership Radio Show. Joe Lewis Walker from his latest album out right now called Blues Coming On. Feed the Poor is the tune featuring Jorma Kukkonen from Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. I want to thank Joe Lewis Walker once again for joining us. If you missed the interview, well, you can hear it once again and anytime you'd like on podcast at themothershipradioshow.com or on Spotify, iTunes, and Anchor FM, just to name a few. Just Google the show, and I'm sure you'll be able to hear it. So that's it for this week. We'll be back with another interview. We're keeping with the blues genre, and next week will be B.B. King's daughter, Shirley King. And you're going to want to hear this one for sure. My name's Kevin Gassman, and thank you for tuning in to the Mothership Radio Show. And always stay strange and unusual.
Thank you, and keep watching the skies.